Okay, so page 30 or 31, depending upon which language you read. Now here we have a little piece of the Gemara, and we're going to learn it like a piece of the Gemara. And it means you have to hold on to your head, make sure you pay attention, catch all the twists and turns. Yochol Meirosh Chodesh. Translation is okay. One might think that the obligation to discuss, tell the story of the Exodus commences with the first day of the month of Nisan. If the first day, "Vigara Telavimcha," tell it to your son. When should I do that? I might have thought, says Agar, that I could do it from Rosh Chodesh on, from the first day of Nisan on. Talmud Lomar. So the verse says, the Torah says, no, you can't do that. Bayomahu, on that day. Oh, on that day. So therefore, it can't be from the beginning of the month. Why not? We'll see. Ah, but I might then think maybe I could do it while it's still daytime. Talmud Lomar, the Torah says exclusively, for the sake of this. For the sake of this, I said only at a time when the matzah and morer are in front of me. Place in front of me. This is the proof that you tell the story the night of the 15th of Nisan. This is the proof. Now let's go through piece by piece. I might have thought that the obligation could start from the beginning of Nisan. Why would I have thought that?
It says Mitzvah in the beginning.
First of all, we're a paragraph above. Yochol Meresh Chodesh. And Mitzvah is a word of the Haggadah. That can explain to me why I would have thought something about what the Torah says. Let's plug in here, boys and girls.
Because that's when the Exodus began.
Do you mean that's when the Exodus began? First of all, so. You're in the right direction. That's the right thought. The right thought is our performance should be linked to what happened to them. That's the right thought. Page 31. But it isn't true that the Exodus started on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Something did happen on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. That's when God told Moses to communicate to the people the first time there's going to be an Exodus. When it's going to be, and how it's going to take place, and what the mitzvahs of it are. Communication started on the beginning of Nisan. So now, the Torah says to me, tell over to your son what happened. When should I do that? I suppose at a time that's connected to what happened. Well, the process started on the beginning of Nisan, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So I might think that, now, understand carefully, I might think that the obligation to tell over the story starts on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. That's what I might think. Talmud Lomar, so the verse says, Bayomahu, on that day. That's wrong. Now, what is there in the words on that day which proves the suggestion is wrong? How do the words on that day tell me the suggestion we were just considering is wrong?
There's no action in the first instance.
I want the words on that day. I'm not asking for our way of thinking that is wrong. I want to know that the Haggadah says you might have thought to start at the beginning of Nisan. Why? Because that's when Moses started telling them about the process. That's wrong. Why is it wrong? Because the verse that tells you to recite the story to your son says on that day. On that day? So the idea of starting at the beginning of Nisan is wrong. How do the words on that day cancel out this thought that I could have started on the beginning of at the beginning of Nisan. No.
On this day, you should say on this day.
That and this don't make a difference in Hebrew. No, don't make a difference. Yeah?
Well, maybe because it says you might think that the obligation to discuss it would start on that day.
Excellent.
And then continue on, and you'd say what happened on this day, what happened on this day. It says on that day. So you have to pick one day and tell what happened on that day.
That's the way you think with Talmudic logic. On that day means there's one day. There's only one day in which you can do this. Suggestion we had was starting with the beginning of the month of Nisan, you have the whole period. That can't be right. It can't be a right picture because the verse is telling you there's only one day in which you can do it. Okay, you with me so far? That knocks out the first suggestion. Okay, the second suggestion is you could do it while it's still daytime. While it's still daytime on what day? You know better than that. The truth is the night of the 15th, right? We're moving up to it. The answer is that not while it's still day, it's wait till nightfall. So it's the daytime of the
14th.
Now why? I'm working with a verse. The verse says on that day. So we pledge allegiance. Oh yes, on that day there's going to be a designated day. One day. It's going to be different from every other day. And that would be the day to do it. Why would the 14th of Nisan be the designated day to do it? Yeah?
Because it says at the end that you should tell your son applies only when you're maximum moral life.
I'm in the middle stage. You're at stage 3. I'm in stage 2. I'm only on the stage which says Yochol Mivod Yom. I might have thought you could tell it in the afternoon of the 14th. Right? I want to know why. Why would I have thought that the afternoon of the 14th is an appropriate time? After all, I already have Bayom Avu on that day, so I know there's one day that's different from all other days, and that day is going to be the designated day to do it. And the Torah says, maybe that day, the one day, could be the 14th in the afternoon. Why would the 14th in the afternoon be the one day that you could do it? What's special about the 14th of the afternoon? Tell them.
Oh, I think I'm wrong. So. I was going to say, otherwise it would say like Halayla.
No, but you don't know which day. Right. We've moved up to the 14th. What's special about the 14th? A Korban Pesach. Paschal sacrifice. That's the first official performance of the whole Seder, offering the Paschal sacrifice. So, the next natural thought, says the Haggadah, is when am I going to tell a story? Well, when I slaughter the animal and my son asks me, what are you doing? It's a different sacrifice. It has different rules and different applications from all the other sacrifices. He's going to ask me what I'm doing. I'm going to say, oh, listen, I'll tell you why. Because we were in Egypt. I'll tell the whole story. That's a reasonable time to do it. That's once a year. It's only one day. It's the 14th in the afternoon. Right? So that's why the middle stage is Yochol. You might have thought you could do it when it's still daytime. No. Talmud Lomar, now watch this move. Talmud Lomar Bavu is there. The verse goes on to say, when you explain the story to your son, use the words Bab Rezeh, for the sake of this, God took me out of Egypt. Now the word this is a demonstrative. You can only say this about something that's in front of you. For the sake of this. So the Haggadah says, when the verse uses the words for the sake of this, it must be at a time when the matzah, the murder, and the paschal sacrifice, if we had it, is placed in front of you, so you can point and say, for the sake of this. That's how I know it has to be at night. You with me? You shouldn't be. There isn't any obvious logic here at all. I have to be able to point. It has to be munachim lefanech, it has to be sitting in front of you, right? So I can point and say, for the sake of this. Couldn't I do that when?
The afternoon 14th.
Couldn't I do that in the afternoon? Couldn't I put the matzah and the maror on the table in the afternoon? How can the words, for the sake of this, which mean that at the point of the matzah and maror, how could they prove that it has to be at night? Now, if you ask this at the seder that you go to, you'll get 5 stars. This is a terrific question. There's no obvious logic here. For the sake of this, when it's in front of you on the table, put it in front of you on the table an hour before sunset and go through the whole story. What's stopping you? Just because it's it for the sake of this? You understand the question? Now the answer requires just one step deeper. let's see, for the sake of this, God took me out of Egypt. Not to sit on the table. I point to Amatis and I say, for the sake of this, God took me out of Egypt. What is this? Think philosophically now. What is the this? I'm pointing to the masses. What is the this that God took me out for? Crackers? That there should be cracker factories starting from Hanukkah and making crackers round the clock, you know, 24 hours a day and shipping them all over the world? God took us out of Egypt so that the Jewish people shall supply crackers? Is that why he took us out? What am I pointing to when I point to the masses? I'm pointing to crackers. I'm pointing to
remembrance.
The mitzvah of eating them. I'm pointing to the mitzvah. Not to the physical crackers. God didn't take us out for the sake of there being physical crackers in the world. God took us out for the sake of our celebrating by doing the mitzvah of the masses. So I've got to point to the mitzvah. Can't point to the mitzvah on the 14th. There is no mitzvah on the 14th. The mitzvah of eating the matzah is only at night. But Erev Tovu Matzos is an explicit verse. You'll eat the matzahs at night. So that being the case, since I'm pointing to the mitzvah, that's only at night. That's built into the understanding here. When it says the words for the sake of this, mean that it's only at night. Because that's the time when the matzah and morah are placed before you. It doesn't mean the physical matzah and morah. Means that the mitzvah is in front of you. And you point to them and say, I have the mitzvah to eat them. And that's only a fact. You with me? Okay, it's just a little hint of what the way Chazal writes with logic and precision and with analysis and with thought. Okay. Mitchila of the Zoro Hayyav was saying, originally, our ancestors were idol worshippers. And now, Amokom, we spoke about that. God being the place of the world, the ground of the surface of the world. The Lord is close to the surface. Now I want you to know that there, the Haggadah here is facing a disagreement in the Gemara and is coming out on both sides. The Mishnah in the Set of Pesachim says, when you recite the Haggadah, Maschilin Bignus Mesaimin B'Shevach. You start with the degradation of the Jewish people and you end with the praise of the Jewish people. Rabbi Shmuel disagree. What is this degradation that you start with? And what is the praise that you end with? One says the degradation is having been slaves, and the praise is because God gave us our freedom. The other says the degradation is that our ancestors worshipped idols, and the praise is that God gave us the Torah. That's the difference between Rabbi Shmuel, what the Mishnah means, and we, since there's no reason not to, we put them both in. We put them both in. We said Avodah Mahina before, that we were slaves and God took us out, and now we're saying the other way. Originally our ancestors worshipped idols, and now Kedroba brought us close to the surface. Question is, what is the nature of this machlokes? What is the nature of the difference? We already said what we're commemorating on the night of the 15th of Nisan is the transition between slavery and freedom. That's what happened on that night. So the one who says you start with slavery and you end up with freedom, of course, you can do no less than that. That's what happened that night. That's what the event was about. What is the thought of the one who wants to go all the way back to our farther remote ancestors, that, as we'll see in the verse of Yeshua, the pasuk goes back to Terach, Abraham's father, and then push forward to receiving the Torah at Sinai. If you thought, you know that history, when you study history, context is very important. You can't study an event in its own setting. You've got to know where it came from and where it led, what it led to. Only if you see the connections of the event can you understand the event. So maybe that authority is telling us, don't focus too narrowly. Don't focus only in going from slavery to freedom. You have to know where it came from. You have to know where it's going. That's a reasonable observation. It's a reasonable gesture, I might say. But now you need to know where to cut off. Okay, basically go back to Terah, Abraham's father. Why not going back to Noah? Noach started the whole of the present population of the world. Right? So his three children and he himself are the father of the entire population. Wouldn't you learn more? Wouldn't you understand more if you went all the way back to Noah? And by the way, you know, to get more out of going back to Noah, why not go back to Adam? And if you're going forward to receiving the Torah at Sinai, why not continue going forward to building the tabernacle where God's presence dwelled among us and go even further forward to taking the land of Israel? Aren't they also consequences of the exodus from Egypt? Aren't they important? Don't they shed light on the understanding of the exodus from Egypt? It can't just be a general feeling. Filling it in more context increases your understanding. Because if the feeling is filling in the context increases your understanding, there's no motivated way to know where to stop. How far back should I go and how far forward should I go? The one who says you must start with idol worship and go to the receive the Torah at Sinai must be saying more than that. What he must be saying is that this piece of context is crucial. Without this piece of context, you're not going to understand at all. Yes, if you filled in more context, you'd get better understanding. Deeper understanding, quite right. But this is necessary because without this piece of context, you don't understand at all. What could motivate an idea like that? That if you don't have this piece of context, you don't understand at all. Now, I told you the answer last night. Those of you who were here. I didn't say it in these terms. I didn't say it was the answer to this question. That's what I said last night. Could be used to answer this question today, if anybody can do it.
Repeat the question.
I'll try to do it short. Yeah. What is the reason why one authority says you must fill in? Our ancestors were idol worshippers, and God took us close to his service, not further back, and not farther forward. Just that context. That context is crucial. Without that context, you don't understand the transition from slavery to freedom.
Because it says in the end of the Shema that God took us out so he could be our God. The reason we were taken out is to serve him, and so therefore you have to see that our ancestors were idol worshippers, and then he took us out, and then we served him through the Torah.
That's good for you. The transition from idol worship to serve God's service is the reason why he took us out. If you don't have that, you don't understand what the reason was and what the significance was. We said last night, freedom is not intrinsically valuable. Freedom isn't a good unto itself. Freedom is a means by which you can do other things that are valuable. And just as he said, he quoted the last verse in the Shema, I am Hashem your God who took you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. That's why I took you out. I took you out for that purpose. That was my only commitment to doing it, my only purpose in doing it. So if you don't appreciate that going from slavery to freedom was a part of a larger transition from idol worship to serving God, you don't understand why it happened, and therefore you don't understand its purpose. And that's why he says, if you don't fill that in, you aren't getting it. Okay? Sort of like seeing a doctor inoculate a child against polio or some other disease, right? And you think he's torturing him with a needle. Right? Why do you think he's torturing with a needle? Because you don't know the antecedent. You don't know the consequence. You don't know what this is designed to prevent. You don't know what will happen if it doesn't happen. Without that, you don't understand what you're seeing. Right? Once you understand it, it immunizes him against polio. Well, now you have pills. Once upon a time, it was with you. Then you know what it's for. Then you understand. Could you learn more out of general medical research? You certainly could. But at least you know what it's for. You're not going to identify correctly its identity. Okay. Now let's see the verse. From Yeshua. Yeshua said to the whole people, thus says Hashem, the God of Israel, on the other side of the river your ancestors lived from time immemorial. Terach, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. They served other gods. Who's they? Okay, that's the natural thought. Two out of the three. Terach and Nahor. I want you to know that Maimonides says that Abraham came to his appreciation of God when he was 48. And that he offered sacrifices to idols himself with his own hands. And he only came to the truth when he was 48. Okay, the Kesavrishna says there's another Girsa in the Rambam that says 40. Still, we're talking about a mature adult. We're not talking about a 3-year-old. There is a Midrash that says he was very young. Good, the Rambam's not going with that Midrash. And according to the Rambam, this verse is gold. All of them served idols, including Abraham. Yeah.
Why do we have to mention Nachor?
Good. And why do we have to mention the whole? Right. Very good. Let's go on. But that's a good question. What is Joshua doing here? Sort of casting a general, he's telling the people where they came from. What do I care about Nachor for? You know, the great 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 uncle. And I took your father, Abraham, from the other side of the river, and I caused him to walk through, I led him through the whole of the land of Canaan, and I increased his descendants, and I gave him Isaac. And I gave to Isaac Jacob and Esau. And now your question comes marching back in, who cares about Esau? And I gave Esau the Mount of Seir to inherit it. Who cares about that? Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. Joshua, and then he goes on to discuss what happened in Egypt and all the rest. What is all this extra stuff here for? What do I care that he came from Terah? What do I care about Nachor? What do I care about Esau? His inheritance. There's a lot of deep ideas here, but on the surface, it's very important to remember that God is the creator of the whole universe. There are people who speak of the Jewish God. That's very dangerous. There is only one God. And he's the God of the Nigerians, and he's the God of the Chinese, and he's the God of the Christians, though they don't know it, and he's the God of the Muslims, though they don't know it. He's the one only God. And he runs everything. It was the ancient idol worshippers and polytheists who thought that each god has a sort of local sphere of influence, and it's a local group that he's connected to, and other groups have other gods, and everybody has his own thing. So it's important to know that God was running the life of Terach and Nachor and Abraham, Nachor who got continued on with idol worship, and God gave Isaac two sons, Esau and Jacob. And Esau got his inheritance because God engineered it for him, because that's where he belongs. And Jacob and his children went down to Egypt. God's running the whole story, not just our history. I want you to know a little bit. Terach is an amazing person. Do you know the entire Jewish people comes from Terach? The men and the women. They're all his descendants. Terach is the great granddaddy of the whole Jewish people. Not only that, I'm telling you something which I heard from one of my great teachers, Moshe Meisen, many years ago. Not only that, when Abraham stood up for God in Mesopotamia, Ur Kasdim, and the king attacked him, this we have a Midrash, and he resisted, Terach at first sided with the king and with the local culture, polytheistic culture. But he saw that Abraham was saved from the danger by a miracle, and he changed his mind. The other people, they didn't change their minds. They didn't become monotheists. But he changed his mind. And it says in the Torah that Terah set out from Ur Kasdim to go to the land of Canaan. And he took Abraham with him. Okay, the verse is difficult there. I'm not going to all the details now. Terah set out. Now, he made it to Haran. Haran is 80% of the way from Ur Kasdim to the land of Israel. He was coming to the land of Israel because he knew it was special. Even in those days, he knew it was special. But he didn't make it. Terach had the right gesture, he had the right understanding, he just didn't make it. He didn't make it the whole way. So Terach is an interesting figure, and we have sources based on a Diuk and a Pasuk. In sources that say that Terach did tshuva before he died, and died a tzaddik. Because it says that Abraham will be gathered to his people. That means his soul will be gathered to his people, who are his predecessors. If Terach wasn't a monotheist, he wouldn't say he was gathered to his people. It wouldn't be his people. So Terach did tshuva and died complete. So Terach is a person who himself embodies the transition. Abraham made the transition before Terach did. Abraham grew out of Terach and, you know, initiated the transition, and it was Abraham's example that drew Terach on. But Terach deserves a great amount of credit. Okay, now notice also the juxtaposition. Esav goes to Mount Seir and gets it as an inheritance right away. Why is it alive? He takes up residence there and he runs it. It's his kingdom. Jacob and his children go down to Egypt, and in Egypt they are at first the nobility, the children, the family of the second in command, and then they descend into slavery. So when you look at it, it looks like Esau got a good deal, and Jacob and his family got a very difficult deal. And the point of it is to show you that what happened to Jacob and his children was an investment in an enormously glorious future, which took a long time to bear fruit. What does it mean, I took your father and led him through all the land of Canaan? What's that for? What does that mean? The answer, said the commentators here, is this. When you transfer land, how does a person acquire a piece of land?
Well,
you know, if you have a book, and I sell you a book, so I pick up the book and I take possession of it. I'm going to do it with a piece of land. So one way to do it is to get a start. You get a document. The owner of the field gives the document to the purchaser. Now he has a document which proves that he's the owner. That's how he takes ownership. That's one way to do it. One way to do it is through money. You pay for it. If you pay for it, the land becomes yours. Well, God didn't give Abraham a document, and Abraham didn't pay God for the land. There's a third way called chazaka. Chazaka means demonstrating your ownership through some physical interaction with the field. There's a variety of such interactions that the Gemara discusses. You're learning Baba Basra, some of you, so you have some of that in there. One way is to simply walk through the whole field. So God took Abraham through the land of Israel. That was his act of possession of the land of Israel. Now, okay, I'll leave that. But forward. Blessed is he who keeps his pledge to Israel. Notice present tense, not past tense. Keeps. Blessed is he. For the blood of Holy One, blessed be he, calculated the end. I must tell you, the English here puts in extra words. So far, they seem to be correct, the words. But I'm just going to translate it literally. Yes, it's the end of the bond. So that's what he means. But let's see. Calculated the end. To do according to what he said to Abraham, my father, in the covenant between the pieces. As it says, he, God, said to Abraham, you should know of a certainty that your descendants will be strangers in a land that doesn't belong to them, and they shall serve them. Here the grammar is a little difficult. They, meaning your descendants, shall serve them, the people running the land. Vino some, and they shall oppress them. Now switch the days. And the people of the land will oppress your descendants. Arabe Hashem, 400 years. How many years were we in the land of Egypt? 210. What's Tzachtu, boys and girls? What is going on here? The verse says 400, and we know it was 210. Now, watch this. This verse is three-way ambiguous. You could read it in three different ways. What it says is, your descendants shall be strangers, and they shall serve, and they shall be afflicted 400 years. A, B, C, 400 years. What are the three different ways you could read that? I say it's three-way ambiguous. A, B, C, 400 years.
The entire thing is total 400.
Or?
Each one is 400?
No, I can't get each one.
The last one?
Okay. And also, possibly? Good. Do it good. Now just do the other one.
Can we get a total?
No.
First one.
No, you can't skip over. Okay, watch. Here's how you do it. Either you say, here's what's going to happen. A is going to happen, comma, pause, breath, wait. And B is going to happen, comma, pause, breath. And C is going to happen 400 years. Then the 400 years goes on C alone. Right? That's one way to read it. Another way to read it is, here's what's going to happen. A is going to happen, comma, pause, breath, wait. And B and C are going to happen 400 years. Then the 400 years refers to B and C together. Or, you could read it, here's what's going to happen. A and B and C, 400 years. Then the 400 years goes on all three of them. God wrote the verse to be three-way ambiguous. That gives God leeway. There are three different ways that the verse could come true. That doesn't mean that it's empty. The fact that there are three ways it could come true doesn't mean it's empty. There's an infinity of ways it can't come true. You know, if you ask me, where's the book? And I say, well, it's either on the bookshelf, on the table, or on the chair. I didn't give you no information. You don't have to look in the bedroom. You don't have to look on the floor. Right? I just gave you three possibilities. Now, the Haggadah says, it could have been A, B, C 400 years, A with B and C 400 years, or A and B with C 400 years. There were options. Which way did it work out? The shortest possible way.
A, B, and C.
Or A, B, and C all together were 400 years. You didn't have 400 years of servitude, and you didn't have 400 years of affliction. You had 400 years of being a stranger in a land that didn't belong to them, and then afterwards being enslaved, and then afterwards being afflicted. That's the shortest way to work it out. That's what Haggadah calls a calculation. God calculated the end. Which way shall I apply this verse? Longest, middle, or shortest? And because of the situation in Egypt, that we were almost totally assimilated, we had almost totally lost it, as they say in colloquial contemporary English, so God calculated it to be the shortest possible time and took us out after only 210 years in the land of Egypt, of which about 85 or 90 years were servitude. And only part of that was really affliction, the above and beyond just having to serve. Okay? Now, for those who know the numerical values of the letters, God calculated the end. End in Hebrew is kates. What's the numerical value of Kate? Huh?
190.
Does 190 somehow resonate here?
400
minus 190 is 210. And that's the 210 that they were there. Right? Okay, it just happens to work out. Right? Just happens to work out. You with me? Okay, now the verse ends. And also, the nation they will serve shall I judge, and then they'll go out with great possessions. Also the nation that they shall serve. Which nation is that?
Egypt.
Somebody's awake. That's who needs coffee. Right? Also the nation they shall serve, I will judge. Now I want you to know, I didn't really appreciate this book very recently. When we hear in English judge, we think a judgment could go either way. It could be judged favorably or unfavorably, depending upon the circumstances. But the word judge in Hebrew, when it's a verb, I'm not talking about the nouns of the judges and the period of judges, but when it's judging, it's always negative. I don't exactly know why that's true, but it's true. Ladu, din, is always thinking. It always means thinking things come out bad. So what the verse is saying here is that I'm going to punish them. And the commentators all ask, why should you punish them? All right, you, God, have decreed that this should happen to the Jewish people. For whatever reason. And this nation, in this case the Egyptians, they're not designated by name here, turned out to be the Egyptians, are doing what you designated should happen to the Jewish people. Why should they be judged and punished? One second. Now Ramban asks this question. And he gives two answers. And they're both interesting, and one of them is absolutely fundamental. One, he says, is true. They were carrying out what God decreed to the Jewish people, but their intention was not to do what God wants. Their intention was to protect their own interests. Which means that even if you do something which happens to be objectively correct, if your intentions are corrupt, you can be punished for it. That's extremely important. Because a human being is not just arms, legs, you know, eyes, ears, feet, and hair. A human being is not a physical body flailing around. The being is a mind, an understanding, a goal, values. And the action might be objectively correct, but if it expresses corrupt goals and values, then that can be punished. That's one understanding the Ramban says. The other understanding the Ramban says is that in this prediction, God says there'll be strangers in a land that doesn't belong to them. They will serve and they will be afflicted. It doesn't say anything about murder. It doesn't say anything about murder. But the Egyptians actually carried out murder. When did they do that?
They killed the firstborn.
Not the firstborn. They killed all male children, right? Moses, in fact, wasn't the firstborn. Right? They killed all male children. They threw them into the Nile. That wasn't written into the decree. So for the sake of the fact that they went beyond the decree, they could be held responsible and could be punished. Those are the two answers that Ramban gives. And what you should meditate on in your free time is the idea that the Egyptians, with their free will, could go beyond God's decree. They could do more than God decreed. That's something about free will that's important. Yeah.
Once they go beyond it, they're punished for the whole thing, or just the way they go beyond?
I assume not. It's a nice question. That's nice. I assume that it's only for the part that goes beyond. I would assume that. Unless I had something that forced me to say otherwise, I would assume it's only for the part that went beyond. But murder's pretty bad.
Earlier on, you said that by storm or something, the whole day is. You know, you have the whole day to do it, but then once you go beyond, you're
required
for the whole day.
No. You're quoting what I said over there correctly, but there the point was that the mitzvah was to put it on once a day, so the failure is having a fillingless day. The definition of the failure relates to the day as a whole, but that's not a question of punishment, you know, for, yeah.
Just like you're saying that their intentions were corrupt. Is that different from what we're saying that when we're doing the mitzvah, you have like pure intentions, but before you get like pure, like, you know, pure intentions doing mitzvah for the sake of like the heavens, like we can, you know, there's a sort of medium phase where you know you don't necessarily do like pure intentions, but we say that's okay. So how is that different?
Now think. You know the answer to that question. I spoke about it not too long ago. You know the answer to that question. Talk shol lishma vol lishma. Right? You're right. There's a phase where your intentions are not what?
Pure.
Not pure. So what are they?
Impure.
Well, what does impure mean?
Some good, some bad.
Right. Mixed. It means mixed. Right? We said, of course, you have a pure intention, you have a pure intention, and in addition, an impure intention. We're not talking about an atheist now. We're talking about a person who knows there's a mitzvah and wants to do the mitzvah, but isn't strong enough, so adds together with it an impure intention. It's mixed, right? It doesn't apply to them at all. That's the difference. Yeah.
Why does this paragraph Baruch Shomer finish off you saying, and afterwards they should be with great possessions? Like, after 400 years of slavery, the last thing we want to think about really is these people who have been like making their life very harsh, taking their possessions. It would be and then maybe better to finish like saying, and afterwards they should leave free people. Or,
okay, understand. I think first of all, it's not 400 years of slavery, right? We just said it was 90. Slavery was about 85 years, 90 years. Enough. I don't want to, but let's get the facts on the table straight. Now, okay, you started saying it one way, and then you shifted. I think the second way is better. I can imagine very well that people who were forced into slavery will say, listen, when I leave, I'm taking all your gold. You guys owe it to me. We've been working for three generations for nothing. But the question is not why were they interested in the money. The truth is they weren't interested in the money. That's another stage, but I'm doing one thing at a time. The question is, if you're going to describe the results, that's not the chief result. That's your point. That's your point. Yes, I think that's right, and I think it's really a continuation of the idea that I'm going to judge this nation. I'm going to judge the Egyptians, and not only am I going to judge them, but the Jews are also going to take away their money. It's not so much a statement about the Jews as it is a statement about the Egyptians. On the surface, anyway. A little deeper, there are two things to be said. God says to Moses, twice, if I remember correctly, please tell the Jews, take the Egyptians' money. And they say, why do you say please? Please always means that, you know, there's some special poignancy to the request, and there's perhaps some resistance to it. So the commentators say, the Midrash says, God says to Moses, tell them to take the Egyptians' possessions so that Zakein, that old man, meaning Abraham, won't say, look, you made a promise to me, and you fulfilled the promise that they're going to suffer, but you didn't fulfill the promise they're going to go out with great possessions. So make sure that they take. And according to the commentators, he said it twice because the Jewish people said, look, we don't want money. We're going out, and we're going out to receive the Torah at Sinai from God. We don't want this Exodus to be polluted with a materialistic gain. They were on that level of idealism that they didn't want it to be polluted with a materialistic gain, right? So God says to Moses, I know that, and I know that, and I... You know, I'm happy with that. I cherish that. I respect that. Tell them to take it anyway. Now, what happened to all that gold and other stuff?
Golden cups.
Well, okay, but it was used for the tabernacle. Right? So gold and silver is very important. Gold and silver is very important because God wants us to use the gold and the silver of the world to serve him. So you can't turn your back on gold and silver. You know, you can't turn your back on the physical world. That belongs to other mistaken religious ideas. For us, all the world is raw material to be able to use to serve God. So he says, listen, we'll not make it impure if you take the gold. Because if you take the gold and use it for the tabernacle, that makes it even more pure. You show how gold can be used, you know. So that's, I think that's what's really going on. Yeah? Okay. See if we can do a little bit more. Okay. Whole page. Going great again. The bottom paragraph. I know it's late. I know you're tired because you've been working. Try to pay careful attention to the pronouns here. It is this that has stood by our fathers and us. For not only one has risen against us to annihilate us, but in every generation they rise against us to annihilate us. The Holy One, blessed be He, rescues us from their hand. What is the this?
Havitachto.
Sorry, say again.
Havitachto of Israel. The pledge to Israel that we spoke about before.
Okay. It's the pledge in the previous paragraph. Say to me the words of the pledge which this paragraph is referring to. It's this that has stood by us, our fathers and us, when only one generation lived to Elias, and why every generation has wrote with face on their hand. Read to me the words from the previous paragraph, which are the this which the last paragraph is talking about.
No.
It says in Genesis when Hashem said to Abraham.
Yes.
No, it says to you in the offspring of the angels.
Oh. You want it to be the whole verse. The first half of the verse talks about servitude and affliction. This paragraph talks about saving us from annihilation. Yeah?
Upon the nation that they share, I'll execute judgment.
And they will leave with great possessions. So the natural thought is, no, it's only the last half. You see, in that instance, God said, the nation of Israel will execute judgment, and they'll leave with great possessions, and that promise of judging our oppressors and enabling us to leave, that promise is what stood by us in all the generations. But some of the commentators here say, no, it's the whole thing. Because oppression also saves us. Oppression also saves us. The whole package saves us. And there are many, including the Steve, who wrote an essay on anti-Semitism, based on older sources, which say that the Semitism springs up when Jews become too tranquil, too content, too comfortable, too placid, and lax in their observance. And that the Semitism springs up to force them to reconsider and to push them back into line. So it's the whole of the promise. The whole of it. Indeed, I'll just leave you with a question. We are celebrating the Exodus from Egypt. We celebrate it in song, in poetry, with great gratitude. The standard question is asked. You are thanking God for taking you out of Egypt, out of slavery. Isn't he the one who put you there? Yes, he is. So, if you're thanking him for relieving you from the slavery and the oppression and the affliction, why don't you express perhaps an opposite attitude towards his putting you in there? Why aren't we angry, upset, critical of God? And if we aren't, as of course we aren't, because we recognize that the oppression, the slavery, the affliction was necessary for some ultimate goal, for some ultimate end, why don't we thank him for that? Why don't we thank him for that? There are deep ideas here. You know, I'll leave you to think about this over the weekend, but there are deep ideas here. See if I can add one other thing. I was just, you know, it's all in the present tense. It's all in the present tense. Okay, I have 1 minute. I'll leave you with one other thing to think about. The next page, now I go to start this analysis of the verses and the actual telling of the story of the Exodus. Say, Ulaman, go out and learn. Now, you've learned a little Gemara. Someone in the Gemara wants to establish a point. What is the way he invites the others to pay attention?
Tashma.
Tashma. What does Tashma mean?
Come and hear.
Come and hear. Very good. That's the Babylonian Talmud. The Jerusalem Talmud has a different phrase. Tachazi. Come and see. Okay, the Zohar Kodesh. And other, there's Torah Chamim, which also means come and see. So the Babylonian Talmud says come and hear. The Jerusalem Talmud and the Zohar say come and see. And the Agada says go out and learn. Those are three different directions. Three different conceptions of what you're doing. Right? I've told you so many times, everything in Chazal, every word is calculated. Every word has a whole world associated with it. So think about that over the weekend. Ask people. See what you get. It'll be interesting to hear what you get from people. Why do you have come here, come and see, and go out and learn as the three different introductions to analyzing material? Okay? Good chance.